Blog Talk Radio.
Stardate, 20 April, 2020. It's 4/20/2020. That's about the most interesting thing that has happened today. We continue without soccer. And we continue to do this show without soccer. So we will, as always, try and figure out something to talk about. I'm Mike. Welcome to the Two Guys Soccer Show. I am joined, as always, by my partner in crime. My better half in this journey that we call podcasting. The yin to my yang. Stead, how are you doing?
Brother, I'm hanging in there, man. I'm doing all right. I'm doing all right, man. I am thankful that I am still healthy and my family's good and everybody's just happy to go to bed every night. So I'm wishing everybody the best and just all just try to keep our heads up. And know that sooner or later there'll be some form of entertainment that involves physical activity between adversaries. Preferably a ball will be somewhere in the mix. But if not, as I have always said, we'll take what we can get.
I'll settle for a cockroach race right now.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much, man. My son was throwing two logs into the creek behind the stream behind my house, and I was quite excited to see which one would get around the bend first and which one would get stuck in the rocks that proceeded to inhibit the path on the right side of the bend. So let's just say a tributary racing was the extent of my sporting endeavors today.
Well, that's good. Did you handicap them? Were there pit crews? Was there betting involved? Did you lay odds?
There was a bit of a handicap involved because there was one branch that was particularly had not been lying on the ground in the mud quite as long, and it had a bit better floating potential than the other one that my son had to dig out of the trail we were walking on. That one also sunk a bit quicker, so I thought it wasn't fair between those two. But you know, I ended up throwing the heavier stick and he threw the newer stick. So I figured I could throw mine a little farther than he could. So maybe that way that evened the odds out. But yeah, that was about it. There was no betting though. I don't think my son's quite ready to bet yet. I think we're going to wait till he's about five before we pull out that candle.
You know, you got to get him started early.
It's true.
There's never a bad time. You know, wagering is something that we need to, and especially with legalized sports gambling, there's a future in it.
That's true. Very true.
We are, as always, brought to you by the fine folks at Flanagan's Harp & Fiddle, 4844 Cordell Avenue, Bethesda, Maryland's premier Irish takeout venue. Hopefully soon to be, once again, premier venue for live sports and entertainment. And we hope that that time comes soon. For the first time in a while, we actually have signs of life in soccer, which we'll talk about a bit later. The leagues are starting to come up with some proposals. We're starting to actually have dates when this may start. We actually have some legitimate news that's happening. So we are going to, for the first time in a long time, talk about stuff that's actually related to things that are going to happen on the field, possibly in the near future, as opposed to reviewing things like weird kits and stuff like that as we have the last couple of weeks. Strangely, I'm actually looking forward to this. So before we get started, did you catch The Last Dance last night on ESPN?
I did not. I have it, though, because of my love of MMA, I have ESPN Plus. So that is on ESPN Plus, and I'm going to try and catch that at some point this week. There was a discussion about it going on during the broadcast on Bleacher Report that I was kind of just checking in on every now and then when I had a free moment. But that's definitely in my wheelhouse. That's something that I think wifey and I could watch together, since she definitely remembers those days quite fondly.
I watched the first two episodes on ESPN Plus today. I will advise, do the unedited version. They did one that was where they edited some of the more colorful language out. I did appreciate the mature language in there. It gives them more of an air of authenticity to it. And it is always fun in this kind of childish way to hear Michael Jordan cuss.
That's true.
But, I mean, a couple of things I took away from it. Number one, I continue to be amazed at the documentaries that ESPN Films does, like that arm of ESPN typically
absolutely
does.
Absolutely. We can thank Bill Simmons for that.
Very good job. Very few of them that I have watched, I've been sorely disappointed in. Some of them have had more to do with, like, the subject matter. Like, I just wasn't particularly interested in it. I'm generally a big fan of the 30 for 30s, which give the documentary filmmakers an opportunity to make the films in their way. Certainly, I like the stories and the way that they lay them out, and I think that they're very well done. I mean, there's only been a handful of them for whatever reason that I wasn't too keen on. This one, of course, is a story that, you know, I'm kind of intimately familiar with, insofar as I remember, like, you watching the Bulls of the 90s, and Michael Jordan grew up when I was 18 when he won the sixth and final championship. I remember very well the traveling circus that the Chicago Bulls were. It was interesting to look back and see the fashions of the time. Some of the big suits with the shoulder pads and the long jackets. I'm kind of glad that we got rid of those.
Yeah, the Steve Harvey suit had to go, man. That was a little bit too much.
Yeah, like, I'm not the Mandarin collar on the suits. Like, those are vestiges of a bygone era that probably don't need to come back. So I was a little bit surprised at how antagonistic Jordan was very publicly to Jerry Krause. I think that was my biggest takeaway from it, was just how willing he was to make fun of and belittle Jerry Krause in public. Like, there's archival footage of him just laying into the dude. It is not like friendly banter. You can tell that there's a malicious edge to it.
Right.
You get to see a little bit about just how we always have heard about how tough Michael was in practice.
Yeah,
it's interesting to actually see it done. And I'm amazed that all of this footage sat in a warehouse in Secaucus, New Jersey for 22 years without anybody doing anything with it.
Yeah. You know, that's a conundrum I've noticed quite a bit, is when you see some of these documentaries come out, and it's like you're seeing footage that you just want to go, where was this? This was just floating around, and you had enough footage to put together a very compelling, even mini series of some of these. It's odd. I mean, you really have to wonder, when you are in some level of in the public eye, you're some level of exposure to the mass media, how much footage is actually there with you? I mean, it's hundreds and hundreds of hours that I'm sure the recipients probably don't have much of a clue to how much is actually there and how much is actually just sitting there. Yeah.
They even said, like, they agreed to have the camera crews follow them around for the 97-98 season with the supposition that Jordan would control the footage. So maybe it's just now he's saying, okay, I'm willing to let you do this. But I'm wondering, like, why it took 22 years for it to get to the point. And, of course, he's heavily involved. It's very, very Jordan-centric.
Right.
You know, As it should be. I mean,
yeah. Well, no offense. I really don't want to hear about Horace Grant and John Paxson. I mean, I'm sorry, not really.
It's nice to hear from him. It is interesting that.
Yeah.
Well, of course, Horace Grant wasn't on that team.
No, he wasn't. But, no, he wasn't. But you know, I'm sure they have some some footage of him and you know his recollections of just Jordan as the player.
But he hasn't featured in any of the first two episodes, which is not to say that
primarily about the 97-98 season.
Well, it's all documentaries. It's the primarily about the 97-98 season.
Mm-hmm.
But then you've got to go through all of the backgrounds. So how
right.
does Jordan become Jordan? How does Pippen become Pippen? How does Jerry Krause put the team together? So there is a lot of that. So, you know, the first two episodes focus heavily on actually focus less on the 97-98 season. You get it as a sort of a backdrop where you're not even to the point where Scottie Pippen has come back. They just got to the ring celebration and Scottie Pippen making his speech where the ring celebration was very much sounds like a farewell speech. And through Jordan's second season in the NBA as sort of like the history of it, through his second season where he missed all the games with the foot injury and then comes back
right.
and drops 49 and 63 on the Celtics
yeah.
in the playoffs. I'm sure that there will be more to come. You know, I can't believe at some point when you're talking about a second three-peat that the first one doesn't get talked about.
Right.
Other than a quick glimpse of Horace Grant, there's really been no mention of him. And we know he was a key piece, but they talked about like the trade for Bill Cartwright. And Michael's views on trading Charles Oakley, who was one of his great friends. But so I wouldn't say anything like earth-shattering. Like, well, for the most part, it was all stuff that we knew, other than I would say the most surprising part was just how toxic that relationship between Michael, Scottie, and the front office was. And slightly surprising that Jordan could sit there and say, like, I want to come back. I want to keep this together. And Jerry Reinsdorf would allow Jerry Krause to say, no, we're going to tear this down. Like, why?
Yeah.
I know they were one of the oldest teams in the league at that point,
right.
but it was like they broke it. It feels like they broke it up for the sake of doing it, not because it needed to be done.
Yeah, they were flopping on fools every week, you know? And, yeah, they were the oldest team, but so what? I mean – it wasn't like they crashed out in the first or second round of the playoffs and decided to rebuild. It was, I mean, they're coming off a very dominant championship performance. But I don't know, everything you're saying here is just making this series even more compelling now. So I have to get that going pretty soon. I might even start tonight. I got some, you know, some day job work to do, so I can just put that on in the background, which will definitely keep me from doing all of my day job work. But, you know, that's okay. I'm really curious. I really want to watch this.
That's a good one. So the question of the Monday night was going to be, in 22 years, oh, by the way, some of the commercials are great, like with Kenny Mayne. At first, the State Farm commercial that I saw when I was watching on ESPN+, Plus, they have Kenny Mayne doing his Kenny Mayne bit where he's like, in 22 years, they're going to come out. And I thought for real that he was saying it, and then I realized that it was just a joke. But
right.
I was like, it was great. For a minute there, it actually had me fooled, thinking that he was really saying, like, back in 98 that they're going to put, because it sounds like something he would have said.
Right.
But the commercials,
cool.
That was great. Needless to say, so if they were to do a documentary in 20 years on, I guess, the same sort of subject, the breakup of one of the great teams, who do you think that they would pick? Like in 20 years, who do you think we're going to come out of the archive will we're going to blow the dust off the film reels and we're going to see a high def or whatever resolution version of this Last Dance. Who do you think who do you think that would be?
That was, you know, you can go so many different directions with this, because if you're looking at a team that had the kind of dominance that the Bulls had and you want to kind of equate it to any team over in Europe, you know, in thinking about this, I'm going to have to keep this to the Premier League simply because my knowledge, my depth of knowledge to some of these other leagues just isn't there. But I will say, if there was one team where you could see something like this falling apart due to the recent circumstances that we're seeing, you know, you could see a team like a Paris Saint-Germain being a part of a documentary like this, where a team that was in a top five league, granted it's ranked, it's the fifth league, and could, you know, was extraordinarily dominant in their domestic league, but just couldn't quite get over the hump in Europe. And then with, you know, with what we're seeing, while we're going to see a windfall change in the way transfers are going to work. And you know that I do think that UEFA is just kind of waiting because they have not forgotten about Manchester City and to PSG. You could see that situation potentially falling apart. If any country has not really put in the, like their FA has not put in real effort to make their league a genuine top tier league, mainly because of the structure of their government and the way their taxes work. It is Ligue 1. And even though you have some of the greatest players in the world come out of France consistently year in and year out, and this has been true forever, and their dominance in international competitions, you would expect them to have kind of a bit stronger of a league. So you could see something like that happening. I would say, though, you could see a team like Leicester after this happens, you know, because you know that documentary is going to be made about the 2015-2016 season. I mean, I still get kind of like goosebumps thinking about that season. And you also have the great footage to way to start that documentary with how they lost that semifinal game against Watford to go to Wembley to play in the championship playoff game to go to the Premier League. So, you know, you have that loss. You have 2 years later, you have 3 years later, you have them winning the Premier League, and then you have them kind of hanging around. And then you have this season where they're finishing, you know, look, they're going to finish top four. Granted, though, we still have a lot of games left. You could easily see Leicester finishing seventh or eighth this year with the way they're, you know, they really only, they're one of the, they've won one of their last five games before the league shut down. So, I don't know, especially with also you had the tragic death of their owner, who was seen as a father figure to a lot of the players. He was well-respected as an owner, especially as a foreign owner, especially coming from a country like Malaysia. So there's – or Thailand. I'm not sure. I think it's Thailand. I could be mistaken.
It was Thailand.
Thailand. Yeah, from Thailand. Okay. So, you know, there's lots of intrigue already there. You already have kind of the roots. So you could see, let's say Leicester ends up getting in a situation like Sunderland. And, you know, we have that, you know, Sunderland Till I Die series that's still going on, which is extraordinarily compelling from a team that keeps losing. So I'm going to go with Leicester. I could see that being the team because also Leicester has stolen a lot of hearts in the past 5 years. And granted, they also had a fan base and they had a domestic U.S. fan base because they had quite a few, of course, is a relative term, but they've had American players on their squads in the past. So I'm thinking that's kind of why I'm leaning towards Leicester. I didn't want to go the easy route, and I was trying to think of a team that would actually make a really, really compelling documentary that isn't one of, like, the big five or big six teams, even though I think it's going to go back to a big four pretty soon in the Premier League. So that's kind of where I'm sitting.
When I looked at it, I looked at, like, what was the – and it's about the final season of the Bulls. So in order to do that, you have to have some sense of – a era of an iteration of a team coming to an end, an imminent change that will come. So when I looked at it, there were two that I came up with. The first was the 17-18 Real Madrid, which I think would be wholly appropriate for it because you have the superstar in Cristiano Ronaldo. You had sort of the winning coach who massages the players' egos and is able to hold together this group of superstars and get them to perform at a high level in Zinedine Zidane. You know, you have the sidekicks in the likes of Pepe and Sergio Ramos. You have all the makings of a good documentary, a good, like, Last Dance sort of thing.
Yep.
And there was a sense in the 17-18 season with Real Madrid having won, competing for their third straight Champions League and their fourth in the last at that time 5 years, that there was a little bit of a sense of finality
mm-hmm.
to that. Like,
mm-hmm.
the transfer rumors, the idea that Ronaldo was going to leave persisted. You know, there was always a sense that Zidane had realized his finality in that sort of structure, that a rebuild
mm-hmm.
was necessary, and he wasn't necessarily – did he want to do that? Did he think that he was the coach who could do it? That there was going to be an imminent change.
Right.
And so I thought that that was wholly appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
The other one that
I came
up with was the 2008-2009 Manchester United team for the same reason,
mm-hmm.
insofar as we had a sense going in the summer before, there was the protracted negotiations with Real Madrid and the flirtations between Ronaldo and Real Madrid. And there was always a sense that, you know, Sir Alex Ferguson went to Cristiano and said to him, all right, give me one more year and we're going to see how much we can win this year and then you can go next year, which
mm-hmm.
is what ended up happening.
Yep.
And as they went through and they, you know, they came within two games of competing for another treble and also winning the they win the Club World Cup. They go out relatively early of the League Cup, but they're in the the quarterfinals of the FA Cup, win the Premier League, and become the second team since the Champions League expanded to make it to back-to-back Champions League finals.
Right.
And there was even a sense going into that game that the advantage was theirs, right? We knew that Barcelona was good, but they had won it the year before.
Right.
You know, Ronaldinho was no longer at Barca.
Mm-hmm.
Where, how was Messi and Samuel Eto'o, how were they
right.
going to get on? Oh,
was
yeah.
Henry
and
still on that,
to...
Was Henry still on that Barcelona squad? I think he was still on that squad, yeah.
Yeah, and this idea that Barca had the first time head coach, you know, at that point in time, we didn't quite know how good Pep was,
no.
right?
Mm-hmm.
The legend of Pep had not been built.
Had not begun,
that
no.
Was,
mm-hmm.
That was the start of it. So those were two teams that I kind of, because I like the idea of doing the documentary on Leicester, but how could you have predicted what Leicester was going to be before the season? In order to do something like this, you had to have known ahead of time
mm-hmm.
that there was going to be some sort of ride that you needed to go on over the course of this 9 months.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in both of those cases, I could see that being, you know, there's that inevitable sense of finality. Like, there is going to be a change in this at the end of this. You know, there was a lot of thought at the end of 2009 that Sir Alex Ferguson was going to retire.
Well, that's the season I thought you were going to go for, was Sir Alex's last season. Because, you know, that was one where, you know, that was – they had – it's like you knew they were going to win the league. I mean, you kind of knew it. So there was this sense of, you know, you knew Sir Alex was retiring after 26 years at Manchester United. So I'm kind of glad
you went with
a different season, but I can easily see that season being one as well.
I think the reason why I didn't pick the season that Sir Alex retired was because Sir Alex held the retirement so close to his vest for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And he would have announced it until the final game of the season.
Mm-hmm.
If it hadn't been for the fact that because Man United was being publicly traded for the first time
mm-hmm.
and the IPO was announced, he had to make the announcement because it was considered to be a material change.
Mm-hmm.
And there could have been some really serious penalties had he, so they were kind of almost forced into a spot legally where once he made the decision to retire, he had to announce that he was going to retire.
Mm-hmm.
I think that he wouldn't have gone for that because he didn't want everybody to know that he was going to retire until he made the decision to retire. Remember, I think it was 2002 that he had actually announced that he was going to retire, only to turn around and say that he wasn't.
Yeah, and then stay for another 10 years, you know. Yeah.
And in that time found probably one of his more successful periods.
I believe that's when he won 5 in a row, yeah.
he won the five in a row. They won the It was three in a row. The Champions League, he won just about every trophy at one point in that time that was to be won, other than the FA Cup. Again, more successful reigns was in that second, I guess if you want to call it second iteration. But you brought up Sunderland Till I Die, which I watched for the first time, and I found that to be very interesting. Not what I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, me neither. I haven't finished either. I've only seen a couple of episodes, but because, you know, watching television isn't something I get a lot of time to do, but definitely was really exciting, really excited.
And I didn't know what to make of it, but I think, like, that was another one where they chose the right team at the right time, having just gone down from the Premier League. You're going to get some good things. So you just got to choose something when you're going to do, like, a longitudinal documentary like that.
Yeah,
where you're going to follow around somebody for a season or two, you really got to make sure you pick the right team with the right personalities. We're seeing more and more of that. You know, Amazon's doing it.
Yeah.
Well, with their All or Nothing, they had the one on Man City that I haven't seen yet.
Yeah, well, a lot of this stems from, I don't know if you read this book, because it's a John Feinstein book who, you know, he lives locally. I'm actually quite a fan of his writing, his sports writing, but when he wrote that Season on the Brink book about Indiana basketball, and he did exactly this. He followed Bobby Knight around, and they ended up losing in the first round of the NCAA tournament. And I remember having to read this book for a course I took in college, and I got about halfway through, and I just said my curiosity got the best of me, and I went and looked up how they did that season and found out that they lost. And so I was concerned that that would kind of ruin some of my enjoyment of the book, but I actually maybe want to go back and read even more because I was curious to see how, like, now I was looking to read The Crash and Burn. How is that going to happen? So you got to imagine when you take that type of, I mean, it's kind of what you're saying. When you take that kind of risk, you're going, okay, I'm doing this because I have an expectation of there's going to be something special that's going to occur. And, you know, you could even say, the year that Wenger was dismissed as coach, everyone knew he was going to be dismissed as coach that year. You knew that was going to be his last year, even with his defiance that he was staying and everything like that. Every Arsenal fan knew that that was going to be it. And Arsenal had a very, very, very up and down, bounce around, success, no success season. And a lot of it was surrounding by this kind of cult of personality that Wenger had developed in this whole back and forth with the fans. And some fans are like, he's our coach till the end. Some fans are like, he should have been out 5 years ago. So, you know, that kind of finality that was the first one I thought of course, but I always try to deviate from my set path a little bit. Maybe that's the underlying rebel in me that I'll even rebel against, you know, my own team that I support. But that was another one that I thought you could actually, I'm sure there's a lot of footage there because they lost a lot of games that season.
Yeah, I was going to say, Dom Feinstein has made a career out of doing this. I hadn't read the Season on the Brink, but I've definitely read the ones on the Final Four.
Mm-hmm.
He did one on minor league baseball and one on the Army-Navy game, three of which I've read and I've enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
He has a unique gift for turning something that would be otherwise mundane into a very interesting read. Because
absolutely.
Reading about a season in minor league baseball I'm not sure that you could actually do that as a documentary, because even reading the book, I'm like, there's really, like, you're making me feel interested in stuff that I really probably could care less about.
I know, maybe seeing something from the Durham Mudcats, you know?
Yeah. Like, I mean, he has a whole entire thread, and he always has, like, various threads where he's following different stuff around. One of them is he's, like, following this manager, or not manager, umpire, who's hoping to get promoted to the minor leagues, major leagues, and he keeps writing it, and you're like, you're feeling for this guy, like, what does he need to do? And it turns out that, like, he gets released, like, he's absolutely awful at the end of it, and they rate him as, like, one of the worst umpires in minor league baseball, and there's no, and so the epilogue is, like, he's selling insurance.
Well,
and I'm like,
no,
damn,
literally,
you really made me.
I'm looking it up now. I got to get this book. This book sounds fascinating. I want to read this.
I have I'm
going to get it on my Kindle.
Where Nobody Knows Your Name or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Chelsea Mike got me a copy of it from John Feinstein, and so I read it a couple of years ago. It really is interesting. It's a quick read. It's typical John Feinstein. Like, half of every chapter is recapping the last chapter, so it can get a little repetitive at times. But I do love his style, and I do love how he creates narratives, and he's a very interesting writer, and I love what he does with that stuff. And the fact that he can make me give an emotional care, an emotional crap about something that I otherwise shouldn't not be invested in. But I don't think that could play as a TV documentary. You couldn't do that as like a Sunderland Till I Die. But
yeah, I mean, the closest thing you could do that would be like the Jordan Rides the Bus one. That's probably the closest you're going to get.
Mm-hmm. But that involved Jordan in the story of, like, is he there because he was gambling? What's going on? Why is he playing baseball?
Right, exactly.
How long is he going to do this?
Yeah,
there's a lot of entry around
that.
Yeah,
the baseball was a backdrop to a much more compelling story about what's really going on with Michael Jordan, you know?
Yeah.
Mm.
But speaking of stuff that's actually going on, I want to talk – we talked about Sunderland Till I Die, which I was using as a segue to talk about what's happening on the other side of Time Weir in Newcastle, where we have pretty much reached a point where it's a foregone conclusion that Newcastle are going to be sold to a consortium of Saudi investors. It does not look like the same setup as had been proposed when they were trying to buy Manchester United. It doesn't look like Prince Mohammed bin Salman is going to be as involved. But it definitely is a Saudi investment. The payout's about £300 million, which means that it'll be about 50% more than what he'll double his money. Thing, they've already said that they estimate that they are willing to invest £200 million in upgrades to facilities, infrastructure, and playing personnel.
Mm-hmm.
Which you would and. On one hand, you have that, and then you have, like, all the Geordies saying, oh, well, we're going to get Kylian Mbappe. And it's kind of, I guess, an interesting story. So before I gave you my thoughts, I wanted to get your thoughts on the pending sale of Newcastle United.
Yeah. Newcastle's been in this holding pattern for, I mean, they've just been circling the airport waiting for an investor to tell him to land. And, you know, Mike Ashley has been relatively public about his plans to make money off of this team. And, you know, even from some people that we know who are Newcastle fans who are quite like, yeah, bring on the Manchester City style of owner. You know, we're tired of being in this relegation battle when we were competing for Premier League trophies just, you know, 10, 20, 30 years ago. So, even prior to the Premier League trophies. So it's not something that's too surprising, but again, you know, there will be, you know, UEFA is going to be smelling around at this, and there's going to be quite a bit I think a lot of hands are going to be in the pot here to try to alleviate the concerns for any sort of shenanigans going on when it comes to pumping money in the team. But you can say, though, I think Newcastle, much more so than Manchester City, seem to have the history and the global appeal to be able to prove that the team is bringing in revenue that's comparable to what they hope to put into the team. So I think this is good overall for Newcastle. I think this is probably bad for the Arsenals and the Tottenhams of the world. I mean, you. The ownerships of those two clubs have been able to compete very well for quite a long time, especially Arsenal. But, you know, the American owners at Arsenal have no support from the fan base, and they've also proven that they are in this to make money as opposed to actually putting a legit winner on the table. And then number two, you know, Spurs, just they're just not there. They just don't have that kind of global appeal. And it seems like once that bubble kind of bursts of their kind of golden generation they're having here, you could see Spurs being back a team that's kind of battling for a Europa League spot every year. So this will be even worse for those types of teams, because now you have a team that's going to have an influx of cash that is going to be trying to buy big players. I mean, fans are already saying, "Oh shoot, I mean, maybe we can buy Kylian Mbappe now." So, you know, so it's kind of crazy what can pop in people's minds when all of a sudden you get this influx of money. But as we all know, I mean, money equals championships in football right now. And, you know, we'll see what happens with transfers this year, but you know, you're going to see fewer teams that are going to have the funds to be able to afford the big name players. So I think you're going to see an even more shallow mountaintop, I'll say, in the Premier League. So you could see this actually being just sort of a big of Manchester United, Manchester City, and Newcastle as a team, as the big money teams, unless Abramovich wants to kick even more of his own money into it. So I don't know how I feel about it yet. It's also a Saudi group, and I'm sure that there are lots of people in England are going to be kicking up dust about, you know, Saudi's human rights records and their the situations going on in Yemen, as well as their support for various organizations that are considered to be, you know, not on the Christmas cards for any of the countries in the West, if you know what I mean. I'm trying to choose my words wisely. So this will be one to see. I'd be curious to see what is the first couple of things they do. If they solely focus on just kind of improving the facilities, trying to get the stadium a bit nicer, then, you know, we can see them kind of doing this slowly. But if they come in right off the bat and you feel that they're offering 60, 70, 80, 90 million pounds for players, then we know what we're going to be dealing with in the long run.
There's a bunch of threads that you brought up, which is why I let you go first, that I get to pull on. You talked about Mike Ashley and his public wanting to sell the team. And it's kind of interesting. You can actually almost point to a exact date when it all went wrong for Mike Ashley at Newcastle.
Mm-hmm.
He bought the team in 2007 for £135 million, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I remember in 2007 when he initially took over, like, he was extremely popular,
mm-hmm.
right?
Oh, yeah.
He was wearing the jersey. He was sitting in the stands. He was sitting and having beer in the pubs.
Yep.
You know, I remember the Newcastle, the Time Weir Derby, when Sunderland refused to allow him to wear the Newcastle jersey in the owner's box.
Mm-hmm.
So he put on this weird jersey, Smith 17, which was Alan Smith was on the team but didn't wear number 17, and 17 was a lucky number of his. So he just had this weird jersey made and sat with the fans. There was the footage from 2008 of him having the beer in the Emirates in the stands, which you can't do. And he brought in Kevin Keegan, and everybody loved him. But then September 4th of 2008 is when it all starts to go pear-shaped for him, because he has the big falling out with Kevin Keegan, and the fans just revolt against him. So, like, 10 days later is when he says, "You want me out? I'm out." And it seems like once the fans turned on him for his handling of Kevin Keegan and their allegiance to Kevin Keegan being greater than their like of him, he very much soured on the whole project.
Yep.
And after that, it just seemed like he had completely and utterly lost interest. And you almost get the feeling like he doesn't talk a lot publicly, right? He's only really done, I think, like 14 was the first time he ever did a full interview, right? He comes across almost as somebody who was never really popular with people growing up. So when he was popular, he loved it. But then when he made a decision and everybody didn't like him, he kind of really personally, and he's like, "Oh, you're really not my friends. I'm going to take my ball and go home."
You go home, yeah. Yep. He's been trying to sell his team for 10 years.
Yeah, but it's funny that it all started, like, it wasn't all bad.
Yeah.
To start with. Right.
It's funny, though, how quickly he turned around and just, and what you said, it's like, "Well, fine, I'm taking my ball and going home." It's like, buddy, you've been there a year and you made a mistake. Or maybe, I mean, I don't know, apparently made a mistake, considering you've been relegated quite a few times. But it's sad in a way that's been able to carry on until 2020.
Yeah, and this feeling is like if it was a choice, oh, they don't love me, they love Kevin Keegan more.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, he's done more for the club. And he's, I thought you guys were my friends.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, he's basically been trying to sell the club. They've been relegated twice, 2009 and 2016. You know, they were talking about basically a $1 million transfer budget. I remember when they came back in 2010, they had Andy Carroll, and he was knocking mm-hmm. goals for them. Actually mm-hmm. looked like a really legit team. They ran away and hit with the championship that
mm-hmm.
year.
Mm-hmm.
But by
yeah,
that time,
dominated that.
Interest, he was involved in the whole entire thing with Rangers and trying to increase his stake there and then using Ibrox to secure a loan
mm-hmm.
because he had – through Sports Direct, he had the monopoly on Rangers Club Shop, and he hadn't been paid, so he was able to take his money and equity in the team. So there was that. It's weird how it all went pear-shaped very quickly to the point now where when you talk to fans of Newcastle United, they really don't care that it's right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't think that ownership group would go over as well with a bigger club.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get me wrong, Newcastle are a big club. They have a rabid fan base, but most
mm-hmm.
of their fan base is concentrated in Newcastle.
In Newcastle, right, yeah.
You know, it's not the same sort of global brand that a Manchester United is, right?
Right.
And I know from when they were flirting with buying Manchester United. I myself said, like, if this is what happens, I will really have to reevaluate my fandom.
Mm-hmm.
And the backlash was significant. You can get away with that with Newcastle because they're almost saying, like, hey, Mike Ashley's gone. We might have
yeah.
a competitive team. We really
right.
don't care.
Right.
But you also brought up the fact that, you know, do they have the commercial muscle to justify the expenditure? And so I'll turn that back around on you. Do you think that they have the commercial muscle to make financial fair play work, where they can invest the money out of what the Emirates did with Manchester City and be able to bring in the revenue commercially to balance the books?
Well, I think that depends on whether or not you think Manchester City has done something against the rules.
I do.
And personally, I do as well. So, but their reprimand of 2 years it's currently being appealed. I'm not sure what the appeals justifications are. Like, if you appeal, does that mean that you don't have to serve the penalty, or is it you're serving the penalty and if the appeal gets lifted, then you can just jump back in? I don't know. But I would imagine that if they were to go that route initially, then yes, they would be able to. But I don't think they would be able to keep the watchdogs off of them for too long, because even though Newcastle doesn't have the same international muscle as the previous big four, Manchester City didn't either. So,
well, that was what I thought, and then I did some research, right?
Mm-hmm.
You think of Newcastle as being a very big city, right?
It's not. It's small.
It's
small.
42nd largest municipality in England.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, compared to Manchester, which is fifth.
Right.
But it is not diverse. It is 80% white British, so it's not diverse.
Mm-hmm.
15% unemployment.
Ah. So
and
it's not,
a gross domestic product per cap of $29,000, which compared to Manchester, which is almost $10,000 less per year than Manchester,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a poor, smaller, and much more remote area. Remember, It's about 130 kilometers south of Scotland and or Glasgow, and 277 kilometers north of London, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it is far closer to Scotland than it is to London. I think that you're – and this is why I wanted to bring up Sunderland Until I Die and beforehand. Like, I think you're going to have trouble getting players to come up there.
Yeah.
It is not the most urbane area.
Mm-hmm.
It is not the most diverse area. And I'm not poking fun at it. That's just what it is.
It's just what it is, yeah.
It is a poor area. Again, I'm not poking fun at this. This is something that the people in that area said about themselves. You know, it's like Minnesota. And in so far as the climate, where I'm talking about snow and stuff like
mm-hmm.
that.
Yeah.
It is up there. It is, you're Kylian Mbappe. What is it you're going to have? What is it going to take for you to leave Paris to go to Newcastle?
You're going to Newcastle, yeah. If I'm thinking Newcastle or Madrid, it's probably not too much of a toss up there. Yeah.
You know, and are you going to be able to turn Newcastle into, because you're going to have to be really reliant on commercial endorsements for the bulk of your income, because the income levels tell me that the fans organically are not going to be able to support that team, support that level of expenditure, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You can't jack ticket prices up because you're going to have an empty stadium.
Right. And if you jack ticket prices up, you know what those fans will do.
Yes. Now, are they rabid? Will they go? Will they buy season tickets? Will they show up en masse? Yes. Are they dedicated? Yes. Will they pack out every game? Yes. But we've seen, like, there's a reason why I think that people have been so hesitant to invest in Newcastle and Sunderland, despite the fact that they both almost have a captive market.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like Manchester, where you have Manchester United and Manchester City.
Yeah.
It's not like London, where you have, what, 8 teams that can play in the Premier League on a given
right.
year. It's
right.
not even like Birmingham, where you have it split in between Aston Villa and Birmingham City.
And Birmingham
City,
yeah.
Newcastle is the team in Newcastle. Sunderland is the team in Sunderland. We
yeah.
talk about them as neighbors. They
Sheffield.
Are in
huh? Not even Sheffield, you know? You got
yeah.
Sheffield Wednesday and Sheffield United.
Sheffield
yeah.
United. Right, Newcastle is in Newcastle, Sunderland is in Sunderland. They are geographic rivals, but let's make no mistake, they are two separate cities.
Right.
All right. They are the only team in Newcastle. So why hasn't anybody really been? Because I think the team, as we saw at the end of Sunderland, Sunderland Until I Die, I'm sorry if this is a spoiler for you, but they struggle to make money at that club.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be very interesting to see whether this group is going to be able to commercially capitalize on this and what that looks like. They seem to be indicating that they are going to take the slow approach. Now, they will invest more money into transfers and facilities and infrastructure than Ashley had. We're going to see if in 3 years we are competing for the Champions League, then we will buy players to compete for the Champions League.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, we're not focused on going out and doing the Manchester City, Paris Saint-Germain thing, because they can't. Like, you've got UEFA. UEFA's going to be all over this.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to have to account for every single dollar. And if they had trouble getting players to go to Manchester, you're going to have even more trouble getting a player to go to Newcastle.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
I could see them being in for the likes of Harry Kane or somebody like that. But,
yeah.
Or perhaps like, one of the players, somebody from Celtic or Rangers or Scottish, somebody like that.
Yeah.
I have a hard time seeing how, unless they pay so much over the odds for Kylian Mbappe. And look, so let's talk about, like, you're going to have to pay 200 million odd pounds to get him, because everybody and their mother right now knows that you have money to spend.
Yes, absolutely.
So they're
absolutely
not asking what
you're
the
paying Manchester
market
United fees now.
You're not even paying Manchester United fees. You're paying more, because you think about it. Nobody, you know, and everybody knows you have the money.
Yeah,
everybody,
I guess you're paying
knows what you're trying to do.
There are no
charge. Yeah, they're going to charge whatever they want, right? Not only that, you're going to have to pay the player acquisition costs, right? The contract. How much do you think it's going to cost you over what a Paris Saint-Germain would have to pay Kylian Mbappe to get Kylian Mbappe to decide to go to Newcastle?
Yeah. Well, Kylian Mbappe made $20 million last year.
$20 million
$20 million in Paris, yeah. And
he's a French kid playing in Paris.
Yeah.
For Paris Saint-Germain, which is the biggest club in Paris, with eyes on going to Real Madrid, where he will probably make the same, if not more, money.
Yeah.
Now, if I'm Kylian Mbappe and you're saying, okay, we would love you to come to Newcastle and spearhead our project. We have aims on getting into the Champions League in the next 5 years. The first thing I'm going to say is you're not in the Champions League this year.
Yeah, no. Right, no.
And then how
I'm trying
much
to win
you,
Champions League, not
yeah. How much do
qualify.
You have to pay me to go to a city where I'm going to be under a microscope? I'm going to stick out like a sore thumb. You know, I know that if I'm performing well, the fans are going to be on my side. But if I miss a goal, if I don't score for the first three games, there's going to be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
How much money am I asking for? If Paris Saint-Germain is offering me, if Real Madrid's offering me 25, I'm thinking 35, 40, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the premium that this new ownership group is going to have to pay to get especially non-English players, right?
Yeah.
And let's be honest, there's just not enough world-class English players to field a Champions League side.
No. I think your point, though, about the general location of Newcastle and the general just kind of status of the city, you know, I'm pretty sure that the owners have, because the difference between when Newcastle was successful, the game was much less global than it is now. You know, you had some players that would start for have a couple of Spanish players, or you might have a player from Bulgaria or something like that. But for the most part, I mean, outside of Arsenal, the majority of the English teams are made up of English players when Newcastle was good. So you're looking at now with Newcastle, have they been bouncing back and forth between relegation? You know, it was such a big story when Arsenal only had two players that were from just the United Kingdom. And now it's not all that uncommon to have just a couple of English players start on your squad for any of the Premier League sides. So, I mean, look at Wolves. I mean, that team's basically from Portugal. So, it is going to be very difficult for them to attract players from outside of a money standpoint, because you got to imagine, what could Newcastle, even with new ownership, if they're trying to actually take a slow approach, what could they conceivably pay a player that they could not also make at a club that's not going to be in Newcastle upon sign?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a very good point. It's a very good point.
So that's why I don't think that it's going to be Manchester City redo.
Mm-hmm. Cause that's one thing. I mean, if I had to live in Newcastle or live in Manchester, I'd much rather live in Manchester.
Yeah. The other thing that we got to talk about is, you talked about like the financial clout of the Saudi government, which, don't get me wrong, they have money. Like, Aramco is still the most valuable publicly traded company in the world. Its market capitalization is somewhere around, its current value is somewhere around $1.6
trillion. Trillion, yeah.
Yeah, but they've also shed over $400 million since January.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because nobody's going anywhere.
Oil today was trading – oil contracts were trading in the negatives today at one point.
They were, First time ever that that the price of a barrel of gasoline was below zero.
Zero. And they are literally talking about the fact that there is so much oil right now that they're going to have to pay people to take it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just to say, like, the financial clout of the Saudis compared to what it was when the Emirates groups, Abu Dhabi and Dubai investment arms, bought PSG and Manchester City. I'm not saying that they're broke by any stretch of the imagination. But they just, you know, they can't spend the same sort of silly money maybe that they did, right? You can't just say, okay, I'm going to spend $400 million on Kylian Mbappe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because that money is not there, number one. Number two, oil is a finite resource.
Yes. And more finite the longer we keep, the longer humans just evolve, you know?
Yeah. So that money is not going to be there in perpetuity. And one of the things that they're looking for is other revenue streams. And the question is, long-term, can Manchester or can Newcastle United give that to them?
Mm-hmm.
I will say, though, that there is massive rooms for growth. Like, you know, St. James's Park is a nice stadium. You can increase capacity.
Yep. It's already at over 50,000. Say 55,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, it's 55.
Mm-hmm.
But those, the two stands, like if you look at it, the two of the sides are massively built up, and then the other two are sort of underdeveloped. It looks almost unfinished.
Mm-hmm.
So there is that, you know. The Newcastle sponsorship with Newcastle Brown Ale, that's something that needs to come back.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I was thinking that just earlier, if you're talking about them becoming more of a global brand, I mean, at least in the United States, which is a market that everybody wants. I mean, who doesn't want the U.S. market to support you? I mean, especially for a sports team. And when I'm sure many more Americans know of Newcastle as a beer, much more so than it is as a city. So any way you can incorporate that back into your brand when you're trying to go more global as a football club, I mean, you've got to bring that back. I mean, granted, those were the ugliest jerseys when they had the big, huge orange and blue Newcastle label just kind of stuck on the front of the jerseys, of the black and white striped jerseys, Mike. I mean, I know we talked a lot about jerseys recently, but those jerseys look like they were made.
I did used to have one of those. I don't think that that's going to come back, though, because you got a Muslim nation buying a club. I can't see them going with the beer sponsor.
That looked like that was an iron-on done by your mom before you went to the local rec league, man. I'm sorry. That jersey looked terrible.
But there is room for commercial growth there. It'll be interesting to see how that project develops. Before we move on, I want to give a big shout-out to our sponsor, Flanagan's Huff & Fiddle, 4844 Cordell Avenue, Bethesda, Maryland, Maryland's premier venue, premier Irish takeout restaurant. Go down there, get a growler, get a corned beef and cabbage. You can even get T-shirts and masks while supplies last. Before we run out of time, I guess, there actually was a lot of stuff that I wanted to talk about beyond this, but I want to talk about the Champions League and domestic league plans for return. For the first time, we start to have what seems to be more concrete plans than we have had in the last month to 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the resumption of soccer over in Europe, you know, we've heard from UEFA that they would like to resumed Champions League and the Europa League as a tournament, possibly in July or August. They said that they probably have to, in order for it to go, they have to have some sort of ability to firmly plan it by the end of June. But we've heard that they want to do that. They think that they can do that as a mini tournament in late July, early
mm-hmm.
August.
Mm-hmm.
We have dates. You know, Germany. Many of the teams, some of the teams in the Bundesliga have already resumed training. Kingsley Coman picked up a fine for driving a McLaren to practice instead of his team-issued Audi. Premier League is looking at June 6th. La Liga has three plans, May 28th, June 6th, or June 28th. Bundesliga says mid-May. Serie A, which is the most murky, they said 31 May or June or 7 June, but they're still
mm-hmm.
unclear if they even want to resume the season. Ligue 1 said June 17th. UEFA says the end of June. So we're actually starting to have this. The Premier League said they need 40 days to complete the remaining 11 or 12 games, depending on if you're Arsenal, for the season, which would mean that a game being played, with the teams playing once every 72 hours,
mm-hmm.
which is a lot, but basically that's the load that you're playing if you're playing in Europe at this time.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Not untenable. The EFL, which has over 541 games, was what I saw, totally needing to be played by the remaining teams in the four tiers under the Premier League plus the conference, said that they need 54 days to complete the end of their season. And then we're looking at probably about a 2 or 3 week UEFA window
mm-hmm.
to complete the Champions League. But
mm-hmm.
UEFA, the European Club Association, and the Euro League, European League's umbrella groups are all very adamant that the league should be completed.
Yes.
Behind closed doors. An interesting article, though, on ESPN about just how many people would be necessary to play a game behind closed doors. We're talking about upwards of over 250 people
mm-hmm.
needed as essential personnel to play these games.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what do you think about this? A step in the right direction? Are we seeing signs of movement? Should we get excited? Or is this just wishful thinking?
I actually think it's a step in the right direction. I do. Mainly because the timelines that they're proposing are not much different than what you're hearing from government agencies throughout the world about people being able to kind of venture out of their homes a bit more again. And, you know, let's just say that it takes about 200 people to actually get a game in, you know, but take our careers. We're around, I mean, I know where I work, I'm around 400 people every day and very, very small thumbprint. So that's still less than what it required for me to return to my job. So I do think that it's a step in the right direction. I like the fact that the leagues are still just trying to finish the league, because what they're saying is that their people outside of the players are not going to be getting paid as easily if they do not play these games. As you discussed before about sponsorships, how they're like, if there's nothing for us to sponsor, we're not paying you. At least this gives them something to sponsor. You know that the advertising dollars are going to be somewhat valuable, because even if people cannot attend, you have several people like the two of us talking on this podcast right now who are dying for some sort of live sports to be able to watch. So at least the interest will be there from a visual standpoint, from TV. And again, I'm speaking about this. I'm trying to be as much of an optimist as I can right now. I do like the models. I do. they don't need to do Champions League and the league play concurrently. They can do finish one and then finish the other. You're looking at Europa League and Champions League. They're already down to the last 16 or 32 teams, so they could easily just have home and homes. 72 hours turnaround is it is a lot for that number of games, but you know, that's why you have to start incorporating your bench more. I would like to see possibly them lift some restrictions on the number of subs you can have in a game. Maybe give them four. You know, they can do that just to try to ease the load in some of these players and to keep the games competitive. Kevin De Bruyne brought up a very good point about how if they start games too quickly without adequate training, the players are going to go out there, they're going to get injured. I think we all are going to expect the quality of play to be significantly less because these players are going to be out of rhythm and they're not going to have as much time to train because this layoff has been longer than what they normally have in the summertime in between their league play. So I think as long as the expectations are relatively low for how successful and dynamic the play is going to be on the field, if the goal is to finish the leagues and be able to crown champions, and be able to adjust your calendar for the 2020-21 season, then I say do so. We also are, you know, you're already hearing about, I mean, this one we're probably going to talk about next week or the week after, is how Qatar's looking at possibly losing this World Cup. This might not happen now. So because of the lawsuits brought up about bribery. And it's a possibility that it won't happen. And you can see a country like, that already has the infrastructure set, like the United States, like a Japan or something like that, being able to pick up a World Cup on relatively short notice. So, you know, what I'm using those points to dictate is just that changes can be made and relatively quickly, and things can be done if the mission is to complete it with some relative form of professionalism. It's possible. So I think it's wise for the leagues to not just sit there and say, no, we're not going to do anything until we get the all clear, but to give people something to get excited about and just to raise the possibility of there being some way to just conclude the league, because there are, you know, 75% of the games were complete before this happened, and you would hate to see all that to get flushed down the toilet. I mean, it'd be really, really sad for for everyone who's been involved and who loves this game and who loves professional sports and who loves sports in general. To have nothing to show of it in the end, because you know we're seeing that stateside already with a lot of the college sports. I mean, it's just not going to happen. So, you know, I think it is a step in the right direction, and I hope that it turns into something positive.
I think the completion of the domestic leagues, in addition to being slightly more important, because that we can do without a resolution to the Champions League and the
Europa
League.
Absolutely.
Yes, it will look like a black mark on the record that these weren't completed.
Yes.
But it's also going to be like the first time since World War II that the FA Cup isn't awarded.
Right.
So the completion of the domestic leagues, which will then tell us who's going to be able to compete in Europe next year, I think is more important than resolving the European leagues this year.
Agreed.
And they're probably easier to do because you face less trouble with transnational travel.
Yes.
Especially when you look at, like, the Europa League,
mm-hmm.
which has teams that are competing from all corners
yes.
of Europe.
Yes.
You know, the only way to make that work would be to be able to put all of those teams in one place, but how
mm-hmm.
are you going to do that?
Right.
Focus needs to be on how do we bring a resolution to the domestic leagues prior to August?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Will it be weird? Will it have an asterisk if we don't have a Champions League champion this year? Yeah. If it weren't for the fact that Arsenal and Manchester United had competed in the Europa League the last couple of years, would we really even care who the Europa League champion was?
Yeah, absolutely not. Absolutely not. The Europa League champion you care about is if it happens to be one of the Champions League teams that flamed out that manages to go over there. Because I didn't believe that's
that.
What
or if it's the only time that you care about the Europa League champion is when the Europa League champion is your team. Like, the only reason that
like
I care even remotely about a resolution to the Europa League is it's an avenue into the Champions League for Manchester United.
Yep.
Right. And that is the only reason, because that keeps two avenues open as opposed to closing one down.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm being pragmatic about it, I'd rather see a resolution to the Premier League season than a resolution to the Europa League season.
Absolutely.
Do I care about the Champions League? Yeah, I love it. It is one of my favorite competitions to watch. Would I be willing to say, no, we can sacrifice that to get a satisfactory ending to the questions of promotion and relegation in the English Premier League? Yeah, any day of the week and twice on Sunday.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I do think it's a step in the right direction. I am excited to hear that these dates seem closer than they did a couple of weeks ago, and just the fact that we actually have, even if we do believe that they're not going to be able to be met, like the Premier League has said, like, this is all based on our ability to test safety decreases in cases, and the games are all going to have to be played behind closed doors, right? And all the players and personnel are going to have to be sequestered and closely monitored. But the fact that we could, it almost represents, and I'll leave it at this, it represents a light at the end of the tunnel, which is something that we've been looking for since this all began.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, gives us something to hold on to, which is, I think, out of a lot of things, that's just kind of that's something that people need right now.
We will talk about, I was going to talk about the suspension of promotion and relegation in Liga MX, but I'll save that for next week.
Yeah, because
I want to round up
time for that one.
We do need some time for that one.
Yeah.
With the last 15, 20 minutes that we have together on this, let's talk about some transfer rumors. Because there's nothing more fun to go out than the silliness that is a good transfer rumor. Now, I've been trying for the life of me to figure out the anatomy of a transfer rumor. You are a math teacher, right? A transfer rumor to me almost sounds like a algebraic equation.
Yes.
Where the variables are player, team, and price. Right? And if you have, and as a math teacher, and any algebraic equation, if you have two known values, you can solve for the unknown. So if you have player and price, you can get team. If you have player and team, you can come up with price. If you have player and price, or if you have team and price, you can probably find a way to associate a player with them. But they almost, and to this, I said, Harry Kane wants to leave Tottenham. Harry Kane says in an interview, would like to go someplace and win trophies. Tottenham value Harry Kane at £200 million. X, which teams can afford Harry Kane at £200 million? Well, insert Manchester United.
Yeah.
Insert Real Madrid.
That's probably it.
Because it doesn't seem to me, so I say this to say that there have been a lot of rumors floating around, and they finally came out today, like Manchester United has been quote-unquote priced out of the market for Harry Kane. Now, whether Manchester United was ever in the market for Harry Kane, I don't know. It doesn't necessarily seem to me like the type of signing that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer would make. Harry Kane is a great player, but if, at £200 million, do you really feel like you need him, or could you spend that money better on Jadon Sancho and maybe Saul from Atletico Madrid and Kalidou Koulibaly, or should you spend all of that money on Harry Kane and say we want an attack with Marcus Rashford, Anthony Martial, and Harry Kane? I personally think that I would go with the younger player in Jadon Sancho, and that's one that seems to be pretty much the only one that I can say with any confidence seems to be like it should happen. It almost seems like it's not a matter of if, when that
mm-hmm.
will happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed.
But in lack of any real concrete news, we get to the transfer rumors, and it just seems like anybody can start one.
Yeah, you really can. I mean, all it takes is really just a handshake and a photograph of it, or a tweet, or an Instagram post where you happen to be wearing colors of a squad that somebody wants you to play for. There goes a transfer rumor. Because, you know, if you look at the One Football app.
Oh, did you see the one with Jadon Sancho? About the water?
The water. I didn't see that one, no.
He was doing an Instagram thing, and Ask Me Anything on Instagram. And one of the guys put up, if you're going to Manchester United, take a drink of water. So Jadon Sancho gives this really wry grin and just takes a sip of water. And everybody was going ballistic because that confirmed that Jadon Sancho was going to Manchester
United. Going to Manchester United.
You could have stuff as ridiculous as that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, with that, you know, when it comes to transfers though, this year, I mean, there's been quite a few pundits who, not pundits, sorry, there's a couple of like former executives who said that, at least in England, you know, there are very few teams that have any money to do any transfers this year. It's going to be, you know, and I know that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has sort of said that, you know, it's, you kind of understand that a lot of the clubs that are really not operating in the black too often, who have to stretch to make some transfers, are not going to be making any transfer this year. May have to sell some players that are actually pretty good. And so he was saying that, you know, we're going to be in a position where we're going to actually be able to bring in a lot of talent without having to really go into that $200 million area per player, or $200 million area per player. So, you know, that is going to be the most interesting thing for the transfer's sake, is that when the window does open, how comfortable are teams going to be to spend the money? Because especially by the time the window opens, if we do get the league get back and moving again, the uncertainty around the world is still going to be pretty high. So you could see clubs not really looking to spend a whole lot of money, or not even be looking to maybe sell too many players if they have a contract that they can work with, and maybe going, you know what, let's just keep the players that we have and see what we can do here. Because right now, us spending money to bring in players that were – to replace players that were selling, you know, we don't know how that's going to go. So I think the transfer market is going to be pretty quiet this year. I think we're going to get a lot of rumors. I know on the One Football app, they have the whole section for transfers. You can just scroll through, and they have four dots. And the four dots basically are the how strong are the rumors? How strong are they? And I'm scrolling through, and out of the first 15, 14 of them only have one dot. All the rest, and then there's one that has two dots, and there's one that has three dots a little bit later on down the list. So there really isn't a lot going on in right now. So. I don't think you're going to see a whole lot this year. I think Manchester United is going to make the big splash, but outside of Manchester United, I'm not sure much is going to happen. I think Arsenal will bring in a couple of players because they always like to spend about 20 to 40 million pounds on somebody who they think is going to have some talent. But outside of that, I think Spurs are going to become a selling club again. And you know, we'll see where – basically, well, this is what everybody wants to know. Is Erling Haaland going to stay in Dortmund? Where is Jadon Sancho going to go? Is Mbappe going to Real Madrid? And is Neymar going back to Barcelona? Those are like the big questions that everyone's trying to answer right now. Because I mean, honest, I don't necessarily see Harry Kane being sold this summer, but I do see him being sold at some point soon. I just don't necessarily see it this summer yet. Also, you know, is Manchester United are they looking to sell Martial? Because that rumor's been pumped around. I don't even know where that came from. I think it just came from the fact that they go, well, if they're going to bring in Harry Kane, they have to sell Anthony Martial. There's your rumor right there. So,
no, I mean,
this is going to be sketchy.
I think Manchester United are in a unique position where they do actually have money to be able mm-hmm. to spend.
Mm-hmm. And as Solskjaer said, you know, we will seek to try and take advantage of this market because we do have the financial clout to do it,
mm-hmm.
right? You look at Arsenal underwater with the LA Stadium right
mm-hmm.
now. And so how much money he has and is willing to invest in player transfer, because some of that money, and that's just to say, like, if he's going to spend money, it's going to have to come out of his pocket.
Yes.
Right. Unless he sells Aubameyang and Lacazette.
Mm-hmm.
They've been linked with Thomas Partey and
mm-hmm.
Another winger.
Mm-hmm. They keep going around to Dembele too, which I don't really understand why, but they keep throwing his name out there.
Well, Dembele, Barcelona seems to be willing to sell for like pennies on the dollar.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I read one report where somebody in France said that Kylian Mbappe would be worth like 40 million euros.
Yeah, I read that too. Yeah.
Yeah, that's ludicrous, right?
That's for real. Come on.
That's asinine.
You got your headline, you got your clickbait, now go away.
Yeah, there is no way, unless Paris Saint-Germain was forced to sell by UEFA and was completely broke, that they would sell Kylian Mbappe, one of the hottest properties
mm-hmm.
in all of in European soccer, for
mm-hmm.
40 million.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that this is going to be more of a story of ones that don't happen than necessarily do. Right?
Agreed.
Because, for example, I think Paul Pogba may have to sign another contract at Man United because
mm-hmm.
there is no place for him to move right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Manchester United don't have to take him. And Real Madrid, not only are they not going to pay the transfer fee, they're not going to pay the wages that he's going to want.
Mm-mm.
And that's the big one. They're not going to pay the wages because they see he is a luxury player. He is not a priority for us.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to have to play out another couple of years at Manchester United and actually prove that he's worth the money.
Yeah.
Haaland's not going anywhere. That release fee doesn't kick in until next year.
Yeah.
And nobody's going to has the money or has the desire to pay the money that Borussia Dortmund would actually ask for him this year
mm-hmm.
before
and
the release clause.
They should ask for the moon for that guy.
They would. I would
ask
150, 200 million for
I
him.
I would too. Immediately.
Now, you
yep.
know that the release clause is like 50. Why
yeah.
are you going to sign him right now when you can have him for 50 next year?
50, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't think Harry Kane is going to move unless he moves to Newcastle. This is an actual transfer rumor, but I could easily start one. Newcastle has money. Harry Kane wants to leave. Newcastle can afford Harry Kane, ergo
mm-hmm.
transfer rumor. Plus, Mauricio Pochettino is already being touted as a possible coach for Newcastle. So here is how we can easily start a transfer rumor.
Oh, I love it. I love it. You heard it here first. Email twoguyssoccershow@gmail.com to fight about this rumor. That's us, baby. Harry Kane's in Newcastle.
Yeah.
I'm on board with it, brother. I'm on board.
Mm-hmm. But I think you're going to see more like Real Madrid are talking about how they're going to have to sell Gareth Bale and James Rodriguez on the cheap.
Mm-hmm.
Barcelona, their finances aren't sound.
Mm-hmm.
How are they going to get? They're going to have to sell Ousmane Dembele. How are they going to get the players that they want in? But it's going to be really interesting, almost to the point where you're looking at clubs that are all going to be operating on at least a window transfer ban because
mm-hmm.
who has money to afford to go out and buy these players right now?
Right.
I love it. I mean, the transfer rumor season is funny because, you know, if you're looking at it, like Manchester United could be spending half a billion pounds
mm-hmm.
just on all the players that they've been linked to in the last couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But this is our TMZ
and,
right here, man. I mean, the transfer rumors, this is our TMZ. This is where we can get all of our, you know, we can get all of our dirt right here. It's great.
I do think the Jadon Sancho one to Manchester United, it just seems like of all of them, the one that
fits the one that seems most likely to happen.
It's just too perfect. It's just too perfect. You know?
It checks all the boxes.
It does. Yeah.
It does. It just fits. Plus, he was a Manchester City player who was allowed to walk. Coming back and playing on the red side of Manchester,
mm-hmm.
the commercial revenue would be a great big up yours to City.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
of all of the one that I see being most likely. The other one that I see being very likely is Aubameyang leaving Arsenal.
Yeah, that's probably the one that I think is the second strongest rumor after Sancho. I mean, Aubameyang, 30 years old, still hasn't really won the trophies that he hoped to win in his career. He's got Barcelona and Real Madrid. Those rumors are actually pretty strong for both of those squads who are looking to bring him in as a veteran striker who they know, I think, is going to score even more goals in Spain than he does in England. And it just makes sense to me. He's also, his mother's Spanish, you know, it just makes too much sense. And also Arsenal's just not at the spot where he is going to, you know, they have a really young team right now. And I think they have a lot of talent. It just makes sense to move him, move Lacazette. He's not even getting on the field anyway. I think both of those are going to happen. And hopefully Arsenal can, and as you were talking about with Kroenke, if they're going to bring in anybody, they got to sell those players. And, you know, you can make some money off of Aubameyang right now. This is the last chance you're going to make money off Aubameyang is right now.
So, well, we've only got about 3 minutes left. So as we go out, what are your parting shots for this evening?
You know, I'm normally very eloquent and very thoughtful, and my speech is pretty rapid, but my parting shots this week are just this podcast has been something that I've looked forward to generally, but in the past few weeks, it has been really a source of great joy for me. So I just wanted to say thank you and thanks to producer Paul for keeping this going, because I genuinely, you know, like Monday mornings are always hard, especially for me with, you know, my young kids, and to know that I get to spend the conclusion of my day yammering on about soccer and having a laugh and loving when the other guys come on and we just have a good chat. It really just kind of sets my week off to the right start. So that's just my parting shot. Just a big thank you. And I just hope we keep this going for years to come.
You know, right as you said that, there was a commercial. I'm watching BN Sports, 90 and 30.
Mm-hmm.
Great commercial for the new Germany jerseys that they're going to wear, they were supposed to wear for Europe. They're actually pretty sweet.
Yeah.
Small hoop pinstripes on the home one, and they brought back that teal for the away.
Yeah, I'm looking at them now. Okay, good. Yeah, those look good.
I want to thank you for continuing to come on. This has been one of the things that I look forward to. It's given me a sense of normalcy mm-hmm. in this abnormal time. As always, a big thanks to producer Paul for keeping the trains running on time, and to Flanagan's Harp and Fiddle for continuing to support us even as they go through their own struggles and keep us on the air. So as we wrap up, we did all right this week. We want to send a big shout out to all the guys. We will get in touch with them, and we will hopefully have them, some of them, back on next week. I've enjoyed the last 90 minutes. It's been good to just actually have some real stuff to talk about instead of
having
to make up stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's been fun. So for Mike, for Stead, for producer Paul, this has been the Two Guys Soccer Show. We did all right this week. We'll try and do better next week.